Ah, my friend. Do come and join me in the smoking room. We won't be disturbed in here. Don't worry, the pipe is just for show. None of the members actually smoke. I don't either, in fact. But I find if I repair in here with my smoking apparatus, I get the place to myself for a little while. Don't worry, we'll rejoin the throng a little later, but I thought, given the season and the hour and the weather outside, we might share one or two more true tales of horror and the uncanny, which I've recently turned up in my files. Close the door, and the very best compliments of the season to you, indeed. Now, I have held back some of these stories, well, precisely because they are Christmas stories. Eerie tales of Irish Christmases long, long ago, you might say. And let us be thankful that we're celebrating indoors and not outside, cycling the byroads of County Monaghan, as one civic guard, James Green, was doing at this time of year back in 1945. He was on his rounds, making a late patrol, one night around Christmas that year, when he encountered something so odd, so unexpected, so alarming, that it scrambled his senses. As he cycled the lanes leading to Smithborough, a sleepy little town on the border, Guard Green noticed another bicycle coming towards him. This bicycle had no light on it, and so the bold Guard Green, scourge of crime and disorder from Scotstown to Three Mile House, ordered the cyclist to stop. This the cyclist did not do. He rode on, serenely, unperturbed, and as the bicycle grew closer, Guard Green noticed that the cyclist was dressed like a priest. Green looked on, astonished, as the mysterious bicycle veered away into an adjoining field by passing straight through a locked gate. Green hurried after him, now more alarmed by this breach of the laws of physics than any offence under the laws of the road. He reached the gateway, drew back the bar, and threw it open. There was nothing beyond. No cyclist, no bicycle, no tearaway priest all in black. Not even any bicycle tracks. Just an empty, open, moonlit field. When Guard Green got back to barracks, he collapsed in a faint before being revived, perhaps with the aid of a seasonal sherry or two, to tell his remarkable story, which subsequently made its way into the newspapers. As soon as the story got out, others came forward to report they had also seen the figure of a phantom cyclist in clerical garb, haunting the byroads of Smithborough, gliding silently down its darkened green lanes, beaming no light, casting no shadow, and untethered to the rules of our world. Well, a gentle start to ease us in. No joke for Guard Green, I'm sure, but no doubt a story he told around the Yuletide fireside until his dying day. But my next tale is of a much more sinister hue and had deeply tragic consequences for the man who saw what he should not. Back in the mid-1960s, the Derry People newspaper recalled the story of a man named Joe from the County Down village of Kilkeel, just south of the Mourne Mountains on the fringe of the Irish Sea. On Halloween night in 1932, as locals swapped ghost stories at a gathering, in the spirit of the season, a couple of the assembled youths decided to show off their fearlessness. They would, they loudly proclaimed, ramble through the local graveyard at midnight if anyone was sporting enough to challenge them. A woman's voice from the foot of the table silenced their boisterous boasts. "Remember," she said, "what happened to my husband Joe." Back in the 1920s, Joe had been just as cocksure and arrogant as these young lads in their midnight bravado. Indeed, Joe would often stroll through graveyards, whistling, cavorting late at night to prove that he did not fear what could not be seen. In fact, Joe went further. He would frequently offer to spend a night in a sealed tomb in the graveyard. It was an old graveyard, and many of the tombs had become accessible over the years, and he'd offer to do this for any stakes anyone would care to put up. But he could never find a taker for that bet. But late in the year of 1925, Joe found himself in the grip of a force that he couldn't bargain with or face down or laugh off. None of his bravery, none of his bluster could save him from the deadly consequences of what he experienced that Christmas. It had been a somber end to the year in Kilkeel. Late in November, a young man named Paddy Ronan had been killed in a tragic accident. He fell from his tractor and was crushed beneath it. The accident happened on a narrow laneway near Joe's home. Now, Joe never walked that laneway. He always went by the main road, which was wider and safer underfoot. But that night, as he walked home through the fallen snow from midnight mass in the earliest hours of Christmas Day, Joe was seized by a strange compulsion to take that lonesome, tragic laneway. Halfway down the lane, Joe could have sworn that he heard the distant grinding of a tractor. Now, quite what a tractor would have been doing on that narrow, unlit, unpaved laneway after midnight on a snowy Christmas Eve, Joe couldn't think. But as he proceeded, the sound grew louder and louder, until, coming round a bend in the laneway, he clearly saw the headlights of a tractor rounding the bend and travelling briskly towards him. Joe should have run. He should have turned tail and raced back the way he came, or have clambered away through the fields. Instead, he did nothing. He just stood there. He stood there, rooted to the spot, unable to move or shout or scream, as the lights of the tractor dazzled his eyes and the engine's hum grew to a roar. And through the headlights, he briefly saw the hunched figure of a man behind the steering wheel as the tractor drew right on top of him. And the lights blazed in his eyes, and the engine roared to a crescendo, and then nothing. Nothing. Joe awoke, shaken but intact, flat against the ground on the laneway, around half an hour later. He dragged himself home through the snow, collapsed into bed, and the next morning, Christmas morning, trying to make some sense of his experiences, he made his way back to the laneway behind his house. There had been no more snowfall since the previous day. All was calm and all was bright. And as he crunched through the settled snow along that lonely laneway, Joe cast his gaze down. But there were no tire marks to be seen, no sign that any tractor had rolled down that laneway. No marks at all, in fact, except for those made by Joe's own trusty Sunday shoes the night before. Joe, who had once scorned the supernatural, was utterly changed by the experience. His hair went white almost overnight. his body withered away to flesh and bone. And in March 1926, just 3 months after that fearful Christmas Eve, Joe passed away in the prime of life for no reason any doctor could explain. And at that Halloween party, 7 years later in 1932, Joe's widow told the story for the first time to his friends and neighbors. And all thoughts of moonlit excursions through the graveyard ended for good. That's a sad story to put a chill in your bones. I think I'll join you in another drink. Well, I have another winter's tale of vehicular vicissitude to share with you. Not quite so tragic, and this time from the southeast of the country, from the village of St. Mullins in County Carlow, named after St. Moling, a 7th century bishop venerated as a peacemaker. The village is on the River Barrow, at the starting point of the Barrow Canal, one of many canals built in Ireland in the 18th century. This story is, perchance, an echo of the 18th century, though it takes place in 1931. Once again, as ever, we are assured by the contemporary chronicler who wrote it up for the Leinster Times that all witnesses to this event were of good character and sober habits, and that theirs was not the only such experience along this stretch of road in the townland of Carrigleed. It was November 1931, black nights in the gathering gloom of an Irish winter. A party of girls were being driven home by car after a night out. It was around midnight, isn't it always? And one of the girls needed to be dropped off in St. Mullins. And as the car trundled towards the village, two girls in the front, two in the back, something vague and indistinct began to appear in the distance. Whatever it was, animal, vegetable, mineral, or vehicle, it was growing closer by the minute, taking on a more definite shape. The two girls in the front had the best view, but might have wished they hadn't. They were in no doubt that the object hurtling towards them was a horse and carriage. That in itself was nothing so unusual. Horse-drawn transport was common in Ireland well into the 20th century. No, it was the face of the driver that stopped their hearts cold. This was no headless horseman. In fact, it was no man at all. The coach was being driven by a woman with a full face of deathly white makeup, covered in patches of colour and picked out in beauty spots. It was, without doubt, the face of a fashionable lady of the 18th century, and the carriage that framed it was approaching at breakneck pace, but in total and unearthly silence. Fearing a collision, the driver of the motor car pulled over to the side of the road as the carriage flashed by at furious speed, but still in total silence. As the car drove on, one of the girls begged the driver to stop. What she had seen, she said, wasn't right. And as all the passengers' heads turned to look through the rear window, what they saw was, well, what they saw was absolutely nothing. No carriage, no tracks, nothing. Perturbed, the girls bravely stepped out of the car and examined the dirt road for track. But other than their own, none were to be seen. So what phantoms and shades might have been haunting the road to St. Mullins since the late 18th century. Well, this is mere speculation on my part, you understand, but just half an hour away from St. Mullins stands the ivy-coated grandeur of Woodbrook House, once home in the late 18th century to a certain John Henry Coakley. Like some of the more idealistic members of his class of wealthy landlords, Coakley was moved by Republican ardour to join the United Irishmen in their struggle for a free and egalitarian Irish Republic. He took some part in the 1798 rebellion, fled to the Salty Islands when it was crushed, and was betrayed and captured. And for this treachery to his class and his king, Coakley and his wife Elizabeth were hanged from Wexford Bridge on the 28th of June, 1798. Their bodies decapitated and their heads displayed on spikes for all to see. It's no more than my own private whimsy, of course, but what if the figure seen on the road were Elizabeth Coakley herself, eternally attempting to outrun the reprisals of the vicious redcoats in a futile midnight flight towards freedom? Well, as I said, it's just a theory. Can I offer you a mince pie? Don't actually care for them myself, but I like to force at least one of them down every Christmas. Do one's duty to tradition. Incidentally, I hope you don't mind the music. I do find Christmas music immensely cheering at this time of year, and the gramophone library here has an excellent selection of the rare and the recherché. I suppose Christmas stands out as a beacon in the bleak midwinter because, well, we all know how barren and cheerless January can be. In fact, let me tell you a tale of January a century ago, or at least one that begins in January of 1926. Now, perhaps you think that because you live in a modern, freshly built home, that there are no residual presences lurking in any nook or cranny. Well, perhaps there aren't, but it doesn't always work that way. I can assure you of that. This house, the house in which our story takes place, was itself newly built and modern for its time, on the site of an older dwelling which had burned to the ground years before. It was not dingy, not dark, not isolated. The nearest neighbour was within shouting distance, in a quiet rural quarter of County Louth, west of Dundalk. The house, which came with a decent stretch of farmland, sold to a local man for a pretty penny, and he could hardly have expected the ordeal which would come with the territory. It began, according to the Dundalk Democrat, with rattling doors and windows. Well, such quirks are common to new houses as they settle into their grooves and develop their habits. More disquieting, perhaps, were the sounds coming from the roof. Not from any loft or attic, but from the roof itself. As though something were dancing about wildly across the slates, thumping and thudding on top of the house, the sound echoing through the walls. Word of the haunting, such as it was, spread like wildfire through the neighbourhood. As is so often the case in the stories we explore together, particularly in those from the first half of the 20th century, some local youths took it upon themselves to brave the haunted house as a test of their virility. On cue, about 10 or 11 o'clock, as the group assembled, the dread performance began. Doors rocked, windows rattled, and the ceiling began to sag alarmingly beneath the weight of what sounded like, in the words of our correspondent, a dozen horses prancing on it. By this stage, our intrepid ghost hunters were in genuine fear of their lives, not necessarily fearing the icy clutches of some force from beyond the grave, but seriously concerned that the roof might actually fall in on them. The noises continued without pause until midnight. But the sudden and ominous silence brought no relief to the occupants of the house. For instead of a violent cacophony shaking the house to its foundations, the next noise that came was the soft, slow shuffle of footsteps on the stairs. Footsteps that could belong to no one in the house. They were all accounted for in the living room. Slowly, deliberately, the footsteps descended towards the kitchen. Now truly terrified, the ghost hunters stared at the doorway, waiting for the figure to appear at the foot of the stairs. But it never did. What appeared instead was more frightening still. A shadow. Beyond doubt, the shadow of a short man reached the kitchen door, accompanied by the footsteps. It, or whatever it belonged to, took no notice of the young men's shouts and cries, but simply turned on its heel and made its way back up the stairs once again. And once the shuffling footsteps stopped, the rattling and rocking and pounding on the roof began again and continued until daybreak, at which time, one suspects, those daring young men gave up their adventures in ghost hunting forever. Quite what such a new house had done to earn such a violent visitation was never clear, although locals had their theories. One was that a ghost had been laid in the previous house on the same site, the house that burnt down some years earlier. That ghost, it was said, had been successfully confined to a sealed room. When the house burnt down, the ghost was released and soon took up occupancy in the new dwelling. Whether the haunting and the thumping on the ceiling continued, or whether the homeowner cut his losses and sold the house on, I cannot say. But I caution you thus. If your children do report the sound of hooves thundering across the rooftop this Christmas, well, by all means, tell them it's Rudolph and friends. But keep them away from the stairs, all the same. Now, do you think we've been missed so far? I think we're all right to rattle through a few more stories. I'll tell you what, I'm going to tell you what is, in fact, my favourite story of a Christmas haunting in Ireland. Now, be warned, this story is unlike any ghost story you've ever heard. It features elements of the classic poltergeist legends, but also of violence and bizarre and grotesque apparitions, quite beyond anything I've shared with you before. And it is very well attested. All these details appeared in print in major Irish newspapers at the time of the occurrence. It begins. Do you mind if I light the fire? It's getting a little chilly. It begins not in the depths of winter, but in the balmy late days of August 1927 in County Wicklow, the Garden of Ireland. A man described as a distinguished Dublin citizen, that usually just means wealthy, bought himself a holiday home in a remote corner of County Wicklow. More importantly, he also bought himself the fishing rights that came with it, and there he planned to spend the summer in blissful indolence. In fact, he barely got a moment's peace. It all began in traditional and time-honoured style, bells ringing when no one had pulled them, locked doors swinging open. All that could be written off, of course. Sea breezes are unpredictable and old houses temperamental. The family even turned a blind eye to the shadowy figures that they swore they saw flitting through the corridors. If something was trying to communicate, trying to indicate that the family's presence was unwelcome, it would have to resort to less subtle tactics. As indeed, it apparently did. One bright summer's morning, the lady of the house awoke to find 3 lighted candles arranged around her bed. As warnings go, it was an effective one, as though something in the house was already planning her wake. A few days later, one of the family's maids awoke to find 6 candles arranged around her bed. And at this horrific escalation, the family finally packed up their bags and their fishing gear and fled back to Dublin. And so the house stood, empty and unlived in as it apparently wished to be, all through the autumn and winter of 1927, all through the following summer, right up until Christmas of 1928, when the son of the owner had what struck him as a brilliant idea to liven the festive season. Accompanied by 4 friends, he set out for Wicklow to spend a kind of adventure holiday in the family fishing lodge. After all, what need for ghost stories or party tricks or fireworks if the house could supply all the frisson one would ever need? Now, my friend, knowing all you do about the heedless bravado of young men who set out to challenge the supernatural from all the stories we've shared, what do you think? Do you imagine that they passed a peaceful and untroubled Christmas in the wilds of Wicklow, sneering at the supernatural while they quaffed their wine and munched their turkey? Of course not. You know better than that. But you can't possibly know just how grotesque and extreme would be the terrors unleashed in that remote house at the tail end of 1928. At first, the 5 friends found nothing out of the ordinary, a slight coating of dust perhaps, a musty atmosphere in a house that had lain unoccupied for a year and a half. It was only when one of the young men went back outside to retrieve something from the car that things became, well, perhaps I should simply describe what happened. As the young man ventured out into the clear, crisp December night, he saw, pointing towards him from a darkened window above, an old-fashioned blunderbuss being held by a cowled figure. Thinking he had disturbed an armed burglar or smuggler, the young man ducked behind the car for cover, but soon saw the figure rush from the house and into an outbuilding. Strangely, for a burglar or a smuggler or for any of God's creatures, the figure appeared to pass through the closed door without opening it. The young man rushed back into the house and told his friends what he'd seen, and any skepticism was swiftly dispelled by an onslaught of violent sounds from throughout the house, clattering doors, crashing furniture, and most terrifying of all, the loud crack and boom of gunshots. Just then, the figure appeared again, out of nowhere, and all 5 of the young men saw it. They described it as, you may want to have a quick swig of that brandy. They described it as a cowled figure with a luminous face, wearing a malevolent expression, and with two grotesquely large front teeth, surrounded by wide gaps in its mouth. This monstrous figure then turned away and ran upstairs. So too, as soon as they'd recovered from the shock, did the five intrepid ghost hunters. But they made little progress up the darkened staircase, because every step was met with a hail of bottles, cups, and plates until they were forced to beat a retreat. Back downstairs, they gathered their courage, grabbed torches, and raced back up the staircase, determined to finish what they had started. But now, all was calm. Of that hideous creature and the forces it commanded, there was no trace. At least until one of the men located the trap door leading to the attic. He pulled it down, and the men poked their heads through to peer inside through the darkness. And what they saw was enough to send them tumbling back down the stairs and leaping into their car without a backward glance, never to return to that house. For what they saw inside that attic was the same figure that had terrorized them downstairs, but now hanging upside down from the rafters of the attic, like a bat. Well, all I can say is that this story was reported faithfully, if somewhat skeptically, in every detail I've just described, in perfectly respectable newspapers in 1929. And there is just one coda to the story. It seems that once they returned home, as fast as the internal combustion engine of 1929 would carry them, the five men attempted to make some kind of sense of what they'd seen. One of them sketched an image of the luminous face that would now haunt their nightmares forever, with those horrendous, rat-like teeth protruding from its mouth. All five men agreed that it was a good likeness of what they had seen. And so the young artist folded the paper, secreted it securely in his pocket, and showed it to his father when he returned home with his wild tale of the beasts of Wicklow. He reached into his pocket, carefully unfolded the paper and handed it to his father. His father glanced at it, confused, then handed it back. The paper, you see, was completely blank. The image sketched by that quivering hand with the horror of that face fresh in the artist's mind had quite simply disappeared. All right, I think it's time to return from the land of the melancholy and the macabre, back to the bright lights and the tinsel. Incidentally, just to add a postscript to that story, it was by no means unheard of when phosphorescent paint became widely available around the turn of the 20th century, for mischievous pranksters to coat themselves in it and startle passers-by in graveyards, and quite a few of them came to grief doing so. So if that explanation puts your mind at rest and you can explain away the candles and the rattling doors and the bat-like creature, well, feel free to believe that, and a jolly good Christmas to you. And may I say just how much I've enjoyed sharing these stories with you this year. We really must do it more often, and do please spread the word and invite your friends to join us. And with that, may I wish you sincerely A spirited but not haunted Christmas, with peace on earth and goodwill toward men. Happy Christmas.
There was plums and prunes and cherries, there were citrons and raisins and cinnamon too, there was nutmeg, cloves and berries, and the crusted was nail and with glue. There were caraway seeds in abundance, juice would build up a fine stomach ache, it would kill a man twice after eating a slice of Miss Fogarty's Christmas cake. Miss Fogarty proud as a peacock.